This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Almost exactly 5:05 in the evening. It is the evening edition with Lynn and Kelvin, and it is time for our monthly Movers and Shakers Town Hall, where we invite policymakers, civil society members to come in and answer some of the most pressing questions you have. Today with us is Datuk Liew Vui Kiong, who is the Law Minister in the Prime Minister's Department. First things first, Datuk, thank you so much for joining us on the show.
Thank you for inviting. Thank you so much.
Before we get to our questions, if there's anything you would like to ask the minister, call us at 7733 2900. You can WhatsApp 018-789-8899. You can also tweet us at BFM Radio.
Wow.
So I guess the first question we wanted to ask you is that it's been something close to a year and a half, let's say, which is rounding up, since you took on this portfolio. When you did accept it, what were your personal goals and priorities that you were thinking of achieving in this term?
Oh, let me start. When I started, it was on the bedrock of prayers and hope from all the Malaysians to have this new government. And I came in July last year. And then soon after that, the first parliamentary sitting started on the 16th of July. And it was quite a lot of work then, because I was then also tasked to look into the parliamentary affairs. And with that, the work started to come in, and of course the top priorities for me is to ensure that justice can be accessed by all here in Malaysia easily and quicker. And I think the most important thing is to ensure that it will not burden the people who want to access to justice.
Now, in 2008, you were Sandakan MP under LDP, which was then under the BN coalition. Have you observed differences in serving as Deputy Minister and now Minister in two different administrations?
Thank you for asking these questions. Well, when I came in then in 2008, I was also the Deputy Minister in the International Trade and Industry. Mm. I was serving then under the leadership of Patla as the Prime Minister then. And that subsequently, 2009, when Dato' Sri Najib came in, I was met the Deputy Minister in the Prime Minister's Department, in charge also of the same portfolio. Of course, the most distinct difference is that, you know, as a full minister, you will have the full power and decisions to make. And I think that is the essential difference. And also, I think the jobs that I'm undertaking at the moment has been massive and has been tremendous. It's quite a difference from the last time.
In terms of scope, right? Definitely.
That's
so.
Right.
Yeah.
That's right.
And part of that scope is that we've been talking a lot about law reform. You know, every time we look at the law in our country, it seems almost as if there's definitely going to be someone who says, well, you know, aren't we going to reform? Isn't it time for that? And in January this year, you announced that over 100 laws were under review, but that identifying which laws are to be amended, renewed or repealed hasn't been finalized yet. Do you have any updates for us there?
Yes, first of all, I think we have to understand that not all the laws come under my purview. They are ownerships. Ownership in this case means that some of the laws are owned by the various ministry. The minister in charge of that ministry will have to come up with a policy direction with regard to that particular law. What do they want to do with it? And that, then the whole motion will start once they have decided to either repeal, amend, or have a new law. Once that is said, then the respective Jawatan Kuasa, the task force, will sit down and then look into it. And then, of course, the most important player in this case is the Attorney General Office, who will advise the government of the day with that particular law. And the process will have to start by engaging with all the various stakeholders with the particular law that they wish to amend. In my portfolio, I think there are certain laws that are under me, one of which at this moment, which is a very hot topic, is really got to what we known as the IPCMC, right, bill, which is the Independent Police Complaints on the Misconduct of the Police Officers.
And that's something we'll get to later in our conversation. But just on that note about the process of law reform and I guess just changing policies, it does sound like it's quite a long process, one that might seem a bit bureaucratic. In your experience, what have been some of the complexities involved when it comes to law reform?
I think the most important thing, as I said just now, is to get the minister in charge of that particular ministry to come out with a policy direction. When they decide, let's say, they want to abolish a particular law, then that will be easier. Then all the policy makers, the officer will sit down. But the most complex procedures, I guess, is with regard to the engagement with all the relevant stakeholders, especially members of the public. Because there are certain law can be very, very sensitive to some, while some will take it, from a different angle. This is where I think engagement with the public is very, very important. Public opinions play a certain role as well to tell the lawmakers, and especially the policymakers in this case, as to whether it is popular or not popular, right?
We're speaking today with Datuk Liew Vui Kiong, who is the Law Minister in the Prime Minister's Department. Again, just a reminder that if you have any questions, we're talking about law reform right now, but we're also going to be addressing things like the IPCMC. We might also touch on the Sedition Act. So if you just have any thoughts on the state of law in our country or anything at all that you'd like to ask Datuk VK, you can call us 7733 2900. You can WhatsApp 018-789-8899, and you can tweet us at BFM Radio. Now, there is a question that we do have to ask, and it is one that we have asked, I think, almost all the ministers that we've spoken to in the course of doing this town hall, which is that law reforms across the board was a huge part of the manifesto, particularly in terms of abolishing certain laws. However, we have seen a certain amount of back and forth. I think you've also explained why that might be to a degree. But we do want to ask, do you think the manifesto ultimately was too ambitious in terms of translating that into real-life action, into what you now have to deliver as a minister?
We have to understand that the manifesto was made before the election was held. Then subsequently, when Pakatan Harapan came into power, then the manifesto became like the guide book for Pakatan Harapan to look at. But we must not forget that soon after that, when Tun Dr. Mahathir became the seventh Prime Minister, the first thing he did was to engage the eminent people, whereby the Institutional Reform Committee was formed to look into the various law reforms that required to be undertaken. Not only law reform, but of course institutional reform, civil service, and all the other relevant institutions. So they come out with the recommendations in a period of about 6 months. And that was made from all the manifesto that had been created. They look into that, and then they come out with the recommendation. So this is where I base my works, based on that IRC. And to say that it is a giant manifesto, but I think it is a very good guidebook, guidance for Pakatan Harapan to look at. And in so far as I'm concerned, I have started to implement the various reforms that had been recommended by the IRC.
So what's a realistic expectation for, you know, how quickly laws can change, can be amended or abolished?
Well, I mean, if you ask that question, I think then we have to look back at the history of our countries. I mean, before that, we were colonized by the British government. So during that time, they had introduced a set of law to govern this country. Subsequently, after independence, the law have continued. So some of the law that had been with us before independence are still with us today. So the process to repeal or amend or introduce new law is not like a piece of cake that can be done overnight. It takes sometimes a generation, maybe. We just look at the law on like the ISA before, right? The ISA was introduced back in the 50s, and it took almost 50 years for it to be abolished by the previous government, of which at that time I was there. And so to say that the law must be repealed, must be abolished immediately, we have to look at it, holistically, and to look at the suitability of that law to the country at a given circumstances, a given conditions.
We're speaking today with Datuk Liew Vui Keong, who is the law minister in the Prime Minister's Department. We've been talking about law reforms. Up next, we're going to turn our attention to this issue of hate speech. If you have any thoughts, send them through. Call us at 7733 2900, WhatsApp 018-789-8899, tweet us at BFM Radio. Our lines are open, and we'll be back to continue this conversation after this. It's the Evening Edition, BFM 89.9.
Bringing fresh meaning. BFM 89.9.
It's 5:16 in the evening. You're with Lynn and Kelvin, and live in the studio with us is Datuk Liew Vui Keong, who is the law minister in the Prime Minister's Department. This is our Movers and Shakers Town Hall. Usually this happens an hour later, but we're moving it up a little bit today. So call us. Our lines are open. If you have any questions at all, you can call 7733 2900. You can WhatsApp 018-789-8899 and tweet us at BFM Radio.
And first up on the line, we have Dava. Dava, good evening. What is your question?
Good evening to all of you all. The question is, why hasn't the Sedition Act been repealed? And also the, you know, the UUCA, it also has to be repealed, isn't it?
Dava, thank you so much for your question. YB?
Thank you. Thank you, Dawa, for this question. In fact, the government has already decided to repeal the Sedition Act. Decision has been made. It's just that the repeal will have to be tabled in Parliament. The process is still being undertaken by the Home Ministry. And, of course, there are some provisions in the Sedition Act that need to be transported to the penal court. And that is also under progress at this moment. And then once that is done, I think we will see it being done in Parliament. If not in this October sitting, I would expect it to be done in the March sitting next year.
Now, with that said, Islamic Affairs Minister Datuk Sri Mujahid Yusof Rawa has expressed the intention to include laws to curb hate speech as part of the Sedition Act. So will it be then a new act, perhaps, that will incorporate that? Or, you know, how is this going to work?
In fact, we have decided to incorporate that into the penal code. Our penal code at this moment have provisions that cater for some of the issues that you have raised just now. But we are also taking into the provision under the Sedition Act. So that process is being undertaken at this moment, and I hope that, as I said, we'll be able to table the amendment to the Penal Court sometimes in this coming parliamentary sessions.
So, you know, moving on to talking about the National Harmony Bill, there are plans to have one to regulate hate speech, and it's also been mooted before in the past. Is there any sort of development with that bill?
Well, Kevin, as I had said before, the opposite of hate is love. So these are the feelings that with us as humans, I think we have to look into the context that, you know, if we love one another, we don't really need to have the hate speech law at all. But then, of course, the government has decided that we are going to transport that into the penal court. So the penal court will cater for that. We need to amend the penal court to include the provisions to ensure that our citizens will not necessarily make, remarks that will incite hatred feelings against each other. We are a multiracial society. I think we have to ensure that we look at what we have in common rather than what we have differently. I think the focus must be that to ensure that the unity will continue to progress in our country.
We also have a comment here from WhatsApp from Umaira, who wants to know, could Datuk comment on the recent ruling of the High Court on the Sisters in Islam case? What is the trajectory of the ministry in dealing with bodies such as a fatwa council, which is not democratically elected and not, you know, not at all accountable to the people, but can pass decisions such as this?
Yeah, I think this decision was made by the Sharia court, which is not really in my purview. It is under the Minister of Religious Affairs, my colleagues, Datuk Sri Mujahid. I think he'll be the best person to answer this question.
If you have any other questions that you would like to address to Datuk Liew Vui Keong, do send them through. Again, that number to call, 7733-2900. You can WhatsApp 018-789-8899 and tweet us at BFM Radio.
So I'd just like to briefly go back to talking about the hate, how to curb hate speech in the country, right? What are the considerations when you are thinking of doing that? How do you balance that with freedom of speech, for example?
Well, when we look at the concept of freedom of speech, not everything that we say is enshrined with freedom, because there are certain restrictions that we are guided by. For example, we are not at liberty to just simply say something that is defamatory of a person. I think we have to restrict ourselves from making unnecessary statement against one, because if that is the case, then that person who has been slandered and where who has been slandered would be entitled under the law to file defamatory actions against that person. So I think restriction on the freedom of speech must be controlled by law. Like, you know, if you are in the cinema, we are not free just to go into the cinema and simply scream fire and then cause panic to those people in the cinema. And then after that, if that person is being detained, then he said that, oh, this is my freedom to shout like that. No, that you don't have that freedom, because your freedom to do things with intentions to cause panic is not free, and you have to be liable for your action. I think we have to look at that context. Of course, we in the government, we are liable to be criticized by members of the public. I think I have no problem with that. Our Prime Minister have no problem on that. In fact, the entire cabinet have no problem on that. But it's just that I think criticism must be constructive, and that it must not be personal. Because once you be personal, then that is another different issue, where that person can actually take action against you if that that amounts to defamations. Right.
I'd like to know something actually about that point about criticism, because I think many people still feel sometimes as if they cannot criticize people in power, or perhaps if they do, that they're not heard. So as ministers, I mean, how much do you take on board criticism that you hear, and where are you hearing that from? You know, are people writing to you? Are people, do you hear it from your constituents? You know, where is this feedback coming from?
Well, I think if you look at the advancement of technology at this stage, you know, we have all forms of criticism coming on from through the social medias. And I think we have to take it with a pinch of salt. And then at times we have to rise above it and then see, you know, if it doesn't hurt us. I think if it is too personal, I think we will have to deal with it personally. But then my constituents have also criticized me for this and that. I will go and deal with them and then tell them that these are the issues that I have, and then what are the issues that you have with me. I will deal with them hands-on. I think it is important that we understand why the criticism is being made against us as minister.
So speaking of criticism or feedback that you might like to give, you can send them through today, actually,
sure,
by calling 7733-2900, WhatsApp 018-789-8899, and tweet us at BFM Radio.
Now, since the government announced that they would abolish the death penalty, the discussions have sort of gone back and forth. The latest proposal allows judges to have discretion to impose the death penalty. Why did you seem to settle on this? Well, would you see it as a middle ground approach, and why would you settle on this?
Okay, let me first explain the offences that attract death penalties in the country. At this moment, we have 33 offences that attract penalty. If anyone's being charged and convicted under these 33 offences, the sentence will be death penalty. So 11 of which are capital punishment offences that attract mandatory. That's if you are charged, let's say, for murder, plus the other 9 offences involving terrorism, plus another one against the king, then if you are found guilty of that, then you'll be sentenced to death. That is mandatory. While the other 22 offences are discretionary, where the judge will have the discretion whether to grant death penalty or imprisonment for life or whipping or both, the latter two parts. So the process has been going on for almost 9 months now, But there has been a pushback because the populations, the demographics look at it as where we have a group of people where the loved one had been murdered, right? And then while we have the other group where they had been detained in prison for a number of years. So there are two sections here, right? And I have met both of them. I have listened to them. I have explained to them that in the case of a murder where a person has been convicted by the court, let's say the High Court, it doesn't mean that that person will be sentenced to death by hanging immediately despite the ruling made by the court, because there is still the appellate stage that that convicted person has to go through, and then, of course, to the federal court. And if the federal court confirmed the decision of the Court of Appeal plus the High Court, it doesn't mean that the person can be hanged immediately, because we still have the Pardon Board in our country. The Pardon Board is the highest and powerful body who is chaired by the respective ruler of the state. And they will decide whether to commute the sentence that has been given by the court. And the thing is that sometimes the Pardon Board will take a while to hear the clemency petitions by the convicted person by the court. So the process can be long. It doesn't mean that once the High Court sentenced that person, you will be hanged. Normally, on average, it's about 10 to 15 years. And there's one guy who has been languishing in prison for almost 30 years, waiting to be executed. So these are the situation that I have to deal, and I have met both of them, and the government come out with the decision that we are taking away this mandatory death sentence and then give it to the judge to decide whether he wants or she wants to pass a death sentence or imprisonment to those person who has been charged for death penalty offences.
So we're going to be continuing this conversation after the 5:30 news. With us live in the studio is Datuk Liew Vui Keong, Law Minister in the Prime Minister's Department. And of course, send us your questions. Call us at 7733 2900. You can also WhatsApp 018-789-8899 and tweet us at BFM Radio. We're going to be still talking a little bit about the death penalty, yeah, but also focusing a lot on the IPCMC, because I think people will have a lot of questions about that. So do keep it here on the Evening Edition, BFM 89.9.
Break from monotony, BFM 89.9.
It's 5:35 in the evening. You're with Lynn and Kelvin, and live in the studio with us, Datuk Liew Vui Keong, who is the Law Minister in the Prime Minister's Department. Our phone lines are open. Our Twitter feed is open. Everything is open, yeah, basically. You can call us 7733 2900. You can WhatsApp 018-789-8899. You can tweet us at BFM Radio. We do have a question here from Reeve, who I think in reference to our conversation earlier about this idea of freedom of speech, wants to know, how do you think freedom of speech will improve our society? And does the internet open up the possibilities of totally free speech and freedom of expression?
Well, as I said, there have been abuses on the usage of internet. Unfortunately, we see certain quarters are using the social medias to spread fake news and false information against many personalities, against individuals, against organizations, against the government. I think if we have that kind of a freedom too freely, it's very sad that the abuses are out there to abuse that privilege that has been given to them. I think important thing is that for them to be responsible, and also I think there are situations where when we receive information that we cannot verify as to the truth, I think we should not forward it and make it viral. And I think the freedom of information will have to pay to a certain price here, you see. And it's unfortunately that I think in any country, they will have to control that kind of information being spread irresponsibly by certain quarters for their political agendas or certain hidden agendas.
We also have this question from Diagu, who asks, is the government ready to amend the constitution to give effect in the law based on Indira Gandhi's case where consent of both parents are needed for conversion?
In fact, this issue had been decided by the federal court. the federal court has made it very clear that the word parents include both father and mother. And that has been settled. I think the need to amend that constitution, I think, does not arise. The court has already made that ruling. But I can look into that if there is the need to do that.
But I guess in the case of Selangor, for example, where there are recent movements to introduce unilateral conversion, how does that take into account the conversation that perhaps might be happening on the federal level?
As you know very well, that the federal law prevails over state law.
Mm-hmm.
So any state law that had been passed by the respective state assemblies will not be enforceable. It will be seen as unconstitutional.
And we also have another question from Thiago, who wants to know, are there any plans to take out the law reform division from the AGC to be made by an independent law reform commission instead of being controlled by the AG in order to give a serious independent effect?
Yes, law commission is one of it which is lacking in our countries. If you look at the commonwealths throughout the world, about 150 of them, Malaysia is one of the very few commonwealth countries that still haven't got a law commissions or law reform commissions to look into laws that can be considered as archaic, considered as draconian, and of course to draft things various law as well. I fully support the setting up of the law commission in the country because it will take the heat out from the minister when it comes to deal with public opinion on a certain law. The unit in the AG chambers is a unit that is chaired by the respective officer that has been in the chambers for a period of time. But the law commission will be chaired by prominent, maybe retired judges, a prominent professor of law, prominent lawyers, and then it will be assisted by hopefully 7 to 9 commissioners to look into the various laws that has been given to them to look into. I think this progress is well underway at this moment, and I hope that the respective ministry and all the ministry will support this move to have a law commission in the country. I'm engaging with all the relevant stakeholders, especially the Bar Council, who has been very, very supportive of this idea. They have even come out with their draft bills to the government. We are looking to that, and I hope that we will have a law commission by next year.
So we do have kind of a series of questions from Adam, all of which are a little bit racially skewed. So I'm just going to ask one that I think is really important in terms of what the government does. And it is, what are the government's efforts to handle divergence in race relationship? And I understand that this might not be something that is just for the law to address. But, you know, speaking as a member of this cabinet, you know, what is this something that is being looked at? Is this something that is being considered in terms of how to just ensure that what we've always had in terms of race relationship continues to be there or continues to improve, hopefully?
Yes. I think it is very important that the relationship with each other will have to continue to progress. I mean, my relationship with you, right, is based on the understandings that we are here, both as the citizens of this country. I think it's important that, as I said just now, that we look at what we have in common rather than what we don't have and then criticize and then make it an issue out of it. But I believe that there is no divergence. These sections of this probably the political spheres out there trying to divert us and distract us, you know, from the unity that we have in the country since independence. I think in general, I'm quite happy to note that the people can live together harmoniously. I think Malaysia is a wonderful country where we can all you know, share the common interests and that work together and ensure that we will progress together. I think this is very important. We have been independent since 1957 for Malaya is concerned. And then for Sabah and Sarawak, we joined in 1963. So this has been a very progressive world. I think everyone wants to ensure that you know, Malaysia will continue to progress now and also in futures.
Our lines are open if you have any questions. Again, the number to call is 7733 2900, WhatsApp 018-789-8899, and tweet us at BFM Radio.
Let's talk about the IPCMC bill, which has just been tabled. What impact do you foresee the bill having?
Okay, before I go into the impacts, I think we have to see that we have about 150,000 police officers in the countries. And then we have about 300 police stations. And we have to thank every single one of them, because it is because of them that we are able to sleep soundly at night. Because some of them will go on the street and some of them will patrol the street to ensure that our neighborhood is safe and sound. But unfortunately, of course, throughout the years, since the formation of the police force in our countries, there are some bad apples that we have to look at. And hence, we have the formation of the Independent Police Commissions to look into the complaints of misconduct of the police. I think the impacts will be more on the end user, meaning to say that the police officers, because they're the ones that are affected by this IPCMC. So we are looking into that, and at this moment, progress has been made tremendously. Engagement has been made with all the relevant stakeholders in the last 1 month, and they are very happy that we are actually accommodating to some of the proposals made by the civil societies to amend some of the provisions in the bills. At the same time, I'm also being meeting up with the Association of the Police Forces, because they have quite a number of associations, also the management of the police force, to hear from them as well. So by the time we have the second reading in October, I expect some amendment to be made in the bill itself.
And what are some of those amendments?
Will be to look into the power and the functions, and also the appointments of the commission, because some are complaining that we are giving the Prime Minister too much power in regards to the appointment, and then also with regard to the function. And also, I think with the complaints procedures and the complaints issues. And there are some who said that on the misconduct, what about if the police has committed an offence which is criminal in nature, right? Then that issue will have to be dealt with by the police force itself, because criminality is the purview of the police. But of course, there are issues like bribery, corruption, that will be dealt with by the MACC. So we have to look into the complaints, the nature of the complaints that has been brought against a particular officers. There are complaints maybe to say that, the police officers has not been doing his job, and then I make a complaint to the police station and about this particular case and that particular case, and it's taken the police about 3 months and things like that. These are the complaints that may not be looked into by the IPCMC, because this probably have to do with the discipline and the police thing. But of course, we have complaints about maybe the death in custody, right? And then probably death outside custody, or maybe during detention and all that. These are the cases that can be looked into by the IPCMC. They will investigate the matter, and they can also set up a task force to investigate and deal with it.
We're speaking today with Datuk Liew Vui Kiong, who is the de facto Minister of Law in the Prime Minister's Department. If you have any questions, do call us at 7733 2900. You can WhatsApp 018-789-8899 and tweet us at BFM Radio.
Break from mediocrity. BFM 89.9.
It's 5:47 in the evening. You're with Lynn and Kelvin, and also, of course, live in the studio with us, Datuk Liew Vui Kiong, Law Minister in the Prime Minister's Department. And before that, we were talking about the issue of the IPCMC, and I think, Datuk, you gave us quite a kind of comprehensive overview of all the different conversations that have gone into this, all the different areas that it will be covering. However, there have also, of course, part of why those conversations have been important is because there have been issues raised along the way. Part of that being the Malaysian Bar Council Council. And the main thrust of what they've said is that the IGP being part of the disciplinary board that investigates police misconduct is potentially an area of conflict. Does having the IGP on board pose a conflict of interest?
Well, we have to consider that. I think if there is a particular complaint against the police officers, I think the IGP will have to ensure that partiality will have is placed here, and then to disclose a particular interest, the conflict of interest in this particular case. But if there is a complaint against the IGP himself, then the provision under IPCMC provides that another body will look into that. The body in this case is the state, the KSN, which is the Ketua Setiausaha Negara, to look into that, and then he will have to appoint maybe three to up to seven members to look into the complaints against the particular IGP. So the police force will not have that power to look into the complaint of the IGP. So there will be somebody which is much higher than the IGP in terms of ranking in the government to look into the particular complaints. So this process has been going on with the respective civil societies that have raised their concern on this particular issue. We have taken note of that, and the amendment, if any, will be given to them before we table the further amendment in Parliament.
But why not place the investigation under the IPCMC?
In fact, the investigation is done by the IPCMC. We must not forget that if there is a particular issues that is of public interest, the IPCMC can even set up a task force to look into that. So in this particular case, let's say IGP is involved in it, right? They can even set up a task force to look into the matter, investigate it, everything, and then pass it to the KSN later. So it is quite independent in that respect. And then, of course, there are other issues that if it arose a public interest, then the task force, the IPCMC, will look into it and set up a task force. So I think that is one of the major aspects that we have to accommodate to ensure that I think the other important thing is also to look into the welfare of the police.
Yeah,
they have been also requesting that their welfare to be looked at, including their living conditions, salaries, and all that. We have accommodated the request by the police force as well, and to put that into the IPCMC.
So we have a very simple question here from Raja Ram on WhatsApp, who just wants to know, what about the Printing Presses and Publications Act?
Right. I think that one is one of the laws that I'm looking at, and I'm giving myself the timelines, maybe sometimes in 2020s, to have progress on that.
Okay. Well, we're going to follow up on that with you.
Sure,
now that we have
will.
You and your number, you know we're going to call.
So I just want to briefly touch on international conventions, some of which we tried to sign on to not have been very successful. I guess here you have parties willing to politicize them, even if they aren't necessarily directly impacted by these international conventions. What's the game plan from the government? You know, is the government's messaging strong enough to counter that it might affect certain privileges and certain rights?
Yeah, as we have seen in the last few months, it is quite unfortunate that certain quarters have played up with the sentiments of the people here in the countries, and then give a distorted view and information about certain international treaties. I think these are the things that we have to be very careful and to be cautious about, and to ensure that we do not unnecessarily disturb the racial sentiments in the country. So the government will have to be proactive and to be extremely cautious, because as I said just now, our country is a multiracial country. We have to continue to preserve that. And then the government will take the stance to ensure that international treaty is well taken care of. At the same time, the racial tension in the country also preserved.
So we have seen Tun Mahathir speaking recently about reviewing labour laws in order to reduce over-dependence on foreign labour. Is this something that you're also looking into?
Yeah, this one is up In fact, looked after by my colleague, the Minister Kula in the Ministry of Human Resource. He's looking at it actively, and I believe that the bill will be tabled soon to ensure that we have workers to work in our countries, right? I think important that we give job opportunity also to our people.
I would like to, I mean, I think we spoke about this a little bit further, but I'd also like to understand the relationship between, so for example, if we have Minister Kulasekaran looking into this issue and that falls within his ministry, but then you are also, you know, covering, your portfolio covers law, at what point is there an intersection? At what point is there a collaboration or do they run on, you know, separate tracks?
Well, as I said, because there are certain laws that are under the purview of the respective ministry, I will not have that liberty to encroach into that jurisdictions unless we agree to it. Like I have agreed with the WHO ministry and also the Ministry of Health to look into the drugs matter and decriminalization of some of the drugs. So we have agreed to that, and we have set up. We are setting up a Jawatan Kuasa as well to deal with all this issue on drugs.
Now, in July, Tun Mahathir said that the government will replace the Official Secrets Act with a Freedom of Information Act that's still in the works. How is that coming along?
All right. I have also looked into that and looked into the one that had been passed in the Selangor state government as well as the one in Penang. But this one is concerning the whole country. And I hope to be able to table that Freedom of Information Act sometimes next year.
My next question, I think, is also, again, more to do with your role as minister and also as MP. Do you ever have to contend with any conflict that might arise from your personal views and how you personally feel about, you know, laws or reforms that are needed, and then the line that's held by the party or by the cabinet, by the government, in terms of laws needing to be abolished or not?
Yeah, I think we have to understand the concept of collective responsibility. I think that is applicable to, in the government, in the world. It is important that every minister will have to abide by the decision made by the cabinet. If not, you know, then he will have to take a stand, either to resign if he is not agreeable with the cabinet decision. But there are times that a particular minister may have a private view on a particular issue. That view will have to be kept private, because he may give his view during cabinet meetings and all that. But once cabinet, we have about 28 of us in the cabinet, and once we have decided that this is the decision made by the cabinet, that will have to stand. Even as the Prime Minister said, he will have to abide by the cabinet decisions.
We have a question here from Subra that asks, is there a plan to place CCTVs in prisons and police stations to reduce deaths during custody?
I think we already have that CCTVs in certain detention centres. I'm still checking up on that, because I'll be visiting some of the police station with the, of course, the blessings from the Home Ministry, because this police force is under Home Ministry. But the minister has kindly allowed that, and I'm looking into that, and also looking into the prison reforms in the country, because we have about 70,000 prisoners now in our prison, and about 56% of them are all drug-related offenders, which is quite unfortunate. And some of the offenders are in there because of something that they have possessed in their body, or they're being checked as a positive in their urine and that sort of thing. So they would go in for like 3 years, 5 years, and when they come out, I think they will become like, you know, a problem to the families, to the society, and they will have problems of getting jobs. And I was told under the study by certain groups that 95% of them will go back to prison. And I strongly believe that some of the drug offenders need treatment instead of imprisonment. So these are the things that I'm actively looking at with certain MPs and also certain civil societies, plus the government's officers, to come up with the best solutions to cater these offenders so that our prison will not be overpopulated by these drug offenders. They need to meet treatment rather than imprisonment.
So, Dato, earlier you mentioned a timeline. You know, you're giving yourself till 2020, I think, to look at, was it the Printing Presses and Publications Act? Yes. So with that in mind then, considering the term that you have, do you think that Pakatan will be able to succeed with all promised reforms?
We must accept the, the sayings that Rome is not built in one day. Right, a reform process, as I said, sometimes it takes a generation. It's some of the law that had been passed by the British colonies when they were with us then, before independence, had still with us. So it's a long and tough journey. It's a very complicated journey, but then it is not saying that it cannot be done. I think it can be done, and we have started. I think in our country, I think with the voting age, allowing our young people to vote at the age of 18, and then also to allow them to become the candidates in the future election, in the coming election, in fact, all the consequential law will be amended by this parliamentary session, and with that, all is set for them to become a voter and also for them to become candidate. On top of that, we also have amended our law to allow automatic voter registrations. So that will mean that by the next general election, we will have almost 22.7 million voters out of 33 million population, so which is about 70%. This is in itself a significant change in the country because it has basically changed the whole political landscape in our country. So there are, of course, many other reforms that we have done, but amending the constitution on Article 1-2 to make Sabah and Sarawak equal partners together with here in Peninsula. So this is the thing that I think will be felt over time, and that people will realize that the Pakatan Harapan government has actually started reforming since we took over last year. It's only 1 year plus now, as against the 60 years that we have before, right? So I think given us time, we will be able to fulfill all the reform promises that we made in our manifesto.
Datuk, thank you so much for joining us today. We've been speaking with Datuk Liew Vui Kyong, de facto law minister in the Prime Minister's Department. This has been your monthly Movers and Shakers Town Hall on the Evening Edition, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my, BFM 89.9, the business station.